is Rock and Roll Grad School with your hosts, Heidi Hedquist and Luke Poling.
Hello, kiddies. We're going to have a good time. We're talking with author Brian J. Krampf today about his new book about the one and only Cheap Trick, This Band Has No Past. So apparently what is happening, if you play Janet Jackson's Rhythm Nation on an older laptop, it can cause the laptop to crash.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So apparently it reaches a frequency that is the same speed of an audio vibration that, in the words of Pitchfork, quote, aligns perilously closely with the natural resonant frequency of certain laptop hard drives. The mind-boggling phenomenon, known as vibration resonance, has long wrought technological havoc with structures great and small, notably the Tacoma Narrows Bridge collapse in 1940.
Oh.
Yes. So the fix...
deal.
It is. The fix effects that they just released drives and it adds a custom filter to the audio pipeline that detects and removes the offending frequencies. So, thankfully, if you have an older hard drive, you can get back and rejoin Rhythm Nation if you have left.
Thank God.
Were you able to drive 55?
I was. They were driving 55, I felt.
Not great. The circle?
Well, no, okay. They were great. They were fun. George Thorogood was amazing.
Interesting.
He was so fun. So fun. Sometimes he looked like Rob Perlman, and that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I'd do it.
But he was fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes Sammy looked like Bruce Valanche, which was also kind of fun.
Different fun.
Mm-hmm. But they came, so, first of all, I'm very confused as to why I've always, well, I'm not confused, but it's interesting to me when I see Sammy, it's the first time I've seen him live.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to me that even before our ice cream date, I've always been team DLR.
Mm.
And I still am. But it's kind of weird that I'm not more like equally love them, because Sammy really embodies like my whole outlook on life.
Yeah, I always felt like I was team Hagar, but I feel like by the time I just remember reading back issues of Rolling Stone and the first cover when I guess it would have been 5150 came out and the headline, it had all four of them on there and the headline was Dave Who. And just reading that article at an impressionable age made me think, this David Lee Roth guy is kind of a dink.
Well, he is, but he's kind of a fun dink.
And I was just like, this seems like so much more laid back and so much just more right. let's not no drama, but sort of like, yeah, it's, right. We'll figure it out.
Yes. But, and he also does all the power ballads, clearly my jam.
Right. Well, he wants to know
tequila. No,
how does he know when it's love?
Right. He drinks tequila all the time, even on stage.
Wears open-toed shoes. There's a lot of things.
There's a lot of things that we have in common. Has, you know, humidity affected hair.
Mm-hmm.
Just wants to have a good time. So these are all things. So the show was good. It was really good. It was really fun. Sammy's super fun. I felt like there wasn't a ton of energy early on. And they started with like their new song, which I just feel you got to come out with it. And so, and it wasn't like super fast. And so it just started a little odd, but then he did catch his stride. But what's cool about it, a couple things, was one, Sammy, you know, he took some breaks and Michael Anthony filled in for him.
Mm.
And I wasn't mad about it, because then when he was wailing, he could wail. And so I really appreciated that he knew his limits and wanted to do it right. And just kind of, and Michael Anthony, like, I'm a huge fan now, because he rocked the whole time. Like, he was just jamming the whole time. He was filling in, he was singing, he was pitch perfect. He was, and Sam even said at one point, he's like, dude, you should have been singing all along. Like, it should have just been you. And which he appreciated. And Jason Bonham was the most adorable thing I've ever seen. And he was super fun. And they, and that was like, I think I told you, that was when the whole tone shifted when he like really kind of introduced the band. And then Jason Bonham was like, can we get the let out? And they did rock and roll and they killed it. They were awesome.
I could
Like,
see,
Sammy was just killing
yeah,
it.
that seems like a good one for his range.
It was great. It was great. And so the whole energy shifted, and then they went into a lot more of the hits, and it was a super fun show.
I gotta say, I think I can speak for Heidi when I say this. We both loved this book.
Wow, great.
And
Thank you.
we do not say that to everybody we talk to. I guarantee you that. How long did it take you to put this together? Because it goes into great detail in a fascinating way.
Yeah, it was at least 5 years of research and writing.
And how involved was the band in this? Because there's some things I know Bunny Carlos is sort of the archivist of the band, but then you reference getting bits and pieces from other members as well.
Yeah, the only person I actually talked to was Bunny.
Oh, really?
So all of the quotes from Rick, Robin, and Tom are from secondary sources. But, there's from hundreds of different sources.
Well, that's it. And it doesn't read like taken from, like, it reads so naturally and so fluidly through all of it. And you can hear all of their voices so clearly through it, as well as everybody else that chimes in. It was so good, as Luke said.
Thank
And
you.
why them? I mean, I know why I would pick them, but why them?
Yeah, they're my favorite band. And I'm an obsessive music fan. I have 4,000 records in my house, and but they're my favorite, because like I say in the introduction, all the music I love, glam rock, hard rock, heavy metal, power pop, Cheap Trick's all of it,
They are. Well, and they are often, like we talk about all the time, like your band's favorite band. And
Yeah.
Cheap Trick is one of the just tried and true. Everybody loves them.
Yeah, like everybody from the bands from the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, they're all Cheap Trick fans. Yeah, it's like they talk about a comedian's comedian. Well, yeah, Cheap Trick are kind of that for a rock band.
And the other thing too, like I usually hate in biographies the formation stories. And this was so interesting, the interweaving paths of all four of them and the way they almost came together at times. It's just such a fascinating. Did you know how much of this did you know before you started putting the book together? Did you know you had this incredible story that you got to really dig into?
No, I mean, I knew they were all in bands before Cheap Trick, but talking to a lot of the guys that were in those bands with them, and then talking to more peripheral characters, like there's a gentleman, Russ Freiman, who I heard his name come up in a couple of other interviews, and then I found his brother on Facebook, and I managed to get in touch with Russ eventually, and he ended up being one of my favorite people, and he was able to talk about, he was in one of that band with where Bunny and Robin were in the band together. And he was just a fan and a witness to so much of it. So he was able to tell me about different things. And like finding out that there was that show that was called Fuse, but it was none of the original members, but Bunny and Robin were in it, and because that was Rick and
Right.
Tom's band. That was the kind of thing I had no idea about. And then I forget who originally told me about that, but then one of the last people I interviewed was that guy, Ted Kenny, who put that show on, who was, I tell the story about how he joined Fuse, but then Fuse broke up, but he already had these gigs booked. So he just did it, but it was nobody from Fuse was actually in it,
Right.
So that was a hilarious story to get in there kind of at the last minute, because here you have Robin and Bunny playing in something called Fuse,
It's amazing.
which was Rick and Tom's band. So yeah, the way they all cross paths, Russ is the guy who said cross pollination, which I kind of used as a theme then, because yeah, they were all, you have the band Toons, where you have Robin Zander in a band with Craig Myers and Chip Greiman, who were from the band with Rick and Tom. So there were so many crossovers before they all came together, yeah.
Well, and it was, there were a couple times I had to go back and like, because it is so much where I had to go back and go, wait, okay, wait, who was in this one? I almost need to make a little diagram at point, just because they were so like intertwined through all of it. And then they're in Europe
Right.
back, and then they're in, and I loved the whole like Rick won't move to Australia because his, or wouldn't move because he couldn't take his dog.
Right.
Like that makes me love him even more.
Yeah.
Well, and there's so many like anecdotes too. Like the level of detail is so incredible. Luke and I kept saying that, like the level of detail and some of the stories that came through, even obviously in any book that even involving other artists, like I keep referencing, one of my favorites is the McFleetwood or the John McVie story.
Mm-hmm.
I love that story so much. I tell it all the time.
Yeah. Are you calling my wife a cheap trick?
Love it. It makes me so happy. And, you know, but yes, of all the things, and other than the band, what was the one thing you took away that you were like, I can't believe I didn't know this before?
I think of some of my favorite stories, like that you would never know to ask about. That's one thing, is when you're interviewing people, you know that there's the questions you don't even know to ask, and you just have to hope that the information comes out at some point. And one of my favorite things is the story of Patti Smith tearing up the picture of Cheap Trick, which was one of the conversations I was having with Bunny. I just asked them about what was it like at the record plant or something like that. And at some point he starts talking about Patti Smith. The receptionist told us Patti Smith came in and tore up our picture. And that became one of my favorite things in the whole book. You know, I ended up putting that at the beginning of that chapter, and I just thought it was just hilarious. And that's the kind of thing where that was just lost. Like for some reason, Bunny thought of it at that moment, but it's the kind of thing where, you know, so who knows what kind of stories are in these guys' memories that they could pull out, but you don't know how to get there.
Right.
Yeah. And the set list.
Luckily for me, those set lists are from Bunny, yeah.
That's such a great job of charting the course of the band. And you can see that first record and the second record come together as they're going, here's what they're working on, here's what they're playing. And that all came from Bunny's archives?
The set lists are from Bunny. Yeah, he has the tapes. He has tapes, lots of tapes of the shows. So he just called me up and said, I found a couple of tapes, and then he read me the set list off the tapes, you know.
My God. That's
how did that connection come to be where you were able to have access to him like that? Was it from...
Yeah, it was early on. When I started interviewing people, one of the first people I interviewed was Jim Charney, who worked for Epic Records at the time the band were signed. And Jim was actually in Madison in the late 60s, and he met Ken Animany then. And he's still friends with Ken Animany to this day. And so Ken Animany, you know, managed Cheap Trick from the very beginning until into the 90s. So at some point when I was talking to Jim, he was like, you know, I'm still in touch with Ken. I could put you in touch with him. And that was something I never even thought would be possible. And then Ken is the one who brought Bunny in, which that was really interesting. I don't know how long it took, probably at least a year before the meeting actually happened. But there's always going to be this meeting I was going to have with Ken Animany at his country club, because I actually only live like half an hour from Ken. So when we finally set up this meeting, then Ken emails me and he's like, how would you feel about having Bunny Carlos at the meeting?
And I guess so.
Bunny's manager was involved in that, and at one point Bunny's manager told me that this is the first time that Ken and Bunny were in the same room since the 90s.
Oh my god, wow.
So yeah, I kind of facilitated a little reunion between those two too. But yeah, so then I ended up having this like 3.5 hour meeting at Ken Animany's country club with him and Bunny.
That's such a credit to you, the fact that he had the faith in you conveying this story in such a way that he wanted to pull that meeting together. Like, that says a lot about you from the get-go.
Well, I actually had to do an audition. I had to go to a lunch with Jim Charney. And when I was sitting there at lunch with Jim, at one point I just said, this is an audition, isn't it? That's what it was. Ken asked Jim to go to lunch with me and kind of feel me out and make sure. So I passed the audition, yeah. Yeah, Ken Animany is ecstatic about the book. He really loves it. He's so happy with it. So I'm happy about that.
Have you heard back from any of the other members of the band?
No. Paul Hamer from Hamer Guitars. A lot of the people who helped me out, I emailed them so I could get their addresses and get them advanced copies of the book. And so I emailed Paul Hamer, who I probably talked to 4 or 5 years ago for the book. And I emailed him and asked him if I could get him a copy of the book. And then he emailed me back. He said, I just talked to Rick and Rick wants a copy. I had tried to interview Rick up until the very end, but I got a final thanks, but no thanks from his management, you know, in the last couple of months before the book was locked. And so never got to talk to Rick, but Paul said Rick wants a copy. So I sent two copies to Paul so he can give one to Rick. I don't know when that's going to happen because he said he's going to give it to Rick in person. And I begged him to get a picture of Rick with the book, but he said all I could do is ask. But yeah, apparently Rick is going to have maybe has it now or is going to have it at some point. So we'll see. And I think the publisher is trying to send copies to Robin and Tom through Carla, who runs Trick International. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. You know, one of my goals with the book was not to put anything in there that would piss anyone off.
I was going to say, they can't be disappointed in it.
I don't see how they wouldn't like it. I almost feel like they're going to say, I hope they never say, I wish we would have talked to you, because that would be really painful, but yeah.
Well, it feels like a warts and all kind of biography in one respect, but at the same point, I think part of that is just due to the amount of detail and really like that shows the research in it. But it also just shows the dedication all four of them had to making this thing work come hell or high water.
Yes.
The amount of time, I mean, even today that they still spend on the road, clearly they love doing this. And it's a great testament to their work ethic and what they're able to accomplish.
Yeah. I think that's what's so great about the story is it shows how these are the four guys who stuck it out. These are the four guys who were kind of the best at what they did. And they just had the confidence and kind of almost the recklessness to just pursue this for that long. You know, they were all playing in bands for over 10 years before they got a record deal.
Yeah.
And, but they just kept at it, and they always did it their own way. That's one thing I love about them so much is that they never tried to be anything except this wacky, crazy, weird band that they were.
Right.
And it worked, you know, because they were so good. I think that's why it worked.
Yeah. And now the Dust Jacket mentions that one of the houses you grew up in was across the street from the bowling alley where they were discovered at Sunset Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
Is that one? Is it still there? And did you just grow up with this, like, kind of, that's the place, that's, you know, the sort of holy land where maybe no one else knows it, but I know that's where that happened.
Yeah. I mean, no, I didn't know it then. I only lived in that house, until I think 77, 78. So I was only there. We happened to live there that year, those couple of years, but we were there. That's where we lived on that night in March of 76 when Jack Douglas came to Sunset Bowl. It was literally across the street. I went over there with my mom, and the parking lot of Sunset Bowl is, if you walk straight from our house across the street, you're in the parking lot of Sunset Bowl. And one of my earliest memories is when a few months after that, there was a fire at Sunset Bowl. And I remember my dad holding me, and we were outside, and that Sunset Bowl was on fire. That's probably one of my earliest memories, but it's just a coincidence really. But also that's where my parents' 25th wedding anniversary was in 1997. And I was in that room when it was still had the bar and the stage. Cause now today it doesn't. Mm-hmm. We just had their 50th wedding anniversary there in June. And now it's completely different, but when we had it there in the 90s, it was still the same as it was in the 70s. So I remember what it was like in there.
How did you discover the band as a kid?
Well, I was just always into hard rock and heavy metal. That's what I loved when I was a kid. So they were just one of those bands, but it wasn't until I was in college and started collecting records in more earnest, and I got their first album. Because the first album is what really blew my mind. Because if you know Cheap Trick from like In Color and Dream Police, I don't think you really understand how great they are until you hear that first record. Because that record is different from all the rest of their albums. And it's probably my favorite album of all time by anyone. So hearing the first album was what really blew my mind, where I realized, wow, this is actually the coolest band ever. I didn't even realize how great they were. And then getting the rest of their albums, because I love like One on One from 1981. I love that album. So as I collected the rest of their albums, when I was in college, I just realized that this is my favorite band ever, because Kiss were always my favorite band growing up, you know.
So. And of all the bands to have a connection with, it makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah.
How many times have you seen them live?
It's between 40 and 50. I don't know an exact number. I have over 20 ticket stubs, but there's so many times I've seen them without a ticket at county fairs and different. So it's a lot of the shows I've seen in the Midwest. You know, every summer you used to go to see Cheap Trick a few times at least. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
How many of Rick's guitar picks do you have? Has been thrown in the vicinity.
I don't have a ton, but I have enough. You know, sometimes you just find one laying around.
Right. I know. It like lost its luster. I remember being at a show and my boyfriend at the time got one, and it's on his fridge to this day, and he's a huge Cheap Trick fan, as am I. But after you've been, then you start, you do start to see them and you're like, oh, everyone in town has one of these. Forget it.
Yeah.
I had him throw one. I was on stage for a whole other side story, but like reach into the bucket on top of the amp and throw a handful in my direction and somehow still came away with nothing. So, but anyway.
Tragic.
I know. It's, did you have, to get into the kind of the behind the scenes stuff, did you have a deal to write this book, or is this just something? I know you have a Cheap Trick podcast. Was this just like, I'm going to see if I can write this book and get it out there? Or did you approach somebody and say, I think there's a story here, let me tell you, you know, can you help fund this for me?
Yeah, no, I just started my original.
Oh,
oh, oh, oh. No. Come back, Zoom.
Please.
He'll be back. He's just gonna
catch up in a second. Yeah, they were opening for Aerosmith, and we were filming, doing reshoots on Get Cool, and I was in the production office, and my boss just handed me the. Oh, you okay? Back? There we go.
Yeah, I saw my internet go out for a second. No. All right, sorry about that.
But we were saying how you kind of came to write this. Was this something you pitched and sold, or just was this, I'm gonna write a book?
Do you guys know the 33 and a third books, those small
of course ones?
Yeah, that my original idea was to pitch one of those for about the first album. That was my original thought, but it was when Ken Adamany got involved, and he has saved everything, so there's so much documentation I have in the book that is just stuff he saved. He would just send me pictures of old documents, you know. So I just kept expanding the scope of what I was doing, and at some point Stephen Roth, who works in he did work in marketing for Jawbone, they just switched distributors, so he doesn't actually work for them anymore, but he was a fan of the podcast, and he heard me talking about the book on the podcast, and he emailed me and said, you should see if Jawbone is interested in this book. And so that was the connection to Jawbone. And I sent a couple of chapters eventually to my editor, Tom Seabrook. And yeah, they signed on. And it's such a different book now than it was when I got the deal, because once I got a publisher, all of a sudden Bunny Carlos answered every question I had.
Yeah. Mm.
And Ken Adamany got a lot more enthusiastic too. So since the publisher signed on, I got a lot more information.
Sure.
So it's a much better book after I got the publishing deal than it was even when I got the deal. So,
and I'm assuming I'm assuming the fact that the band has had several people, like you said, act as archivists has was such a huge help and so much more information than you get from other bands. I mean, you have photos of the lyric sheets that Rick would call up the secretary and recite over the phone, and she would quickly transcribe what the words to these songs were. Uh-huh. Not everyone, you know, Kiss doesn't have, I don't think they have, like, you know, Rock and Roll All Night or Beth transcribed somewhere in, like, here's Gene or Paul writing these things out.
Yeah, I mean, Ken Anime still has that from the yellow legal pad. You know, he told me about that. He told me that story that Rick would call up, tell his secretary the lyrics. She would take them down in shorthand and then type them up. And then he sends me a picture of that, and it's all the shorthand symbols. And then down there you see gigolo. You know, there's a bunch of shorthand symbols and gigolo. Because there's no shorthand for gigolo. I remember one time at work that we were having a meeting, and there was a lady, we had a deaf employee, and there was a lady doing sign language, and I remember the sign she did for sexual harassment was a very interesting sign.
Oh, I'm sure. Descriptive. Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes it's just got to be signed the way it is. Do you find yourself listening to anything differently now? Or does it all still resonate the same?
Yeah, well, I have a lot of early shows. One thing that you notice when you listen to as the band progressed, you listen that you hear how Robin became a much better singer.
Yeah.
From 1974 to 1977. I think when Robin joined, because Robin had never really sung in a rock band before he joined Cheap Trick. I mean, I think he was like 21.
Yeah.
When he joined the band, and he was playing in a duo that did mostly like Bee Gees, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Neil Young, stuff like that. So I think Robin didn't even know what he was capable of.
Yeah.
Especially with the screaming, you know, and the crazy. Right. And so I think as Rick started writing more songs and realized what Robin was capable of, you could hear the progression. And Robin kind of realizing how much more there was to his voice than he even knew. I think you can hear that if you hear him in 75 and then later.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have the story in the book about how even after Robin was in the band, Rick tried to get this other singer, George Faber,
yes,
in the band. So, I think when Robin first joined, he wasn't as good because he didn't know, probably didn't have the confidence or even really know. He probably had to be pushed, and a lot of it probably was the songs that Rick wrote.
Yeah.
And it pushed Robin, and Robin, I think, it unlocked his power, you know?
Well, he wasn't as cool either. I mean, that's one of the things I love, like, in the book, too, exactly what you said, going back. Knowing what we know of him now and how he's one of the greatest frontmen of all time and one of the coolest and just everything about him, can you not love him? But going back and even just like figuring out what his look was going to be, and then is he really the guy for us? And it's so great to watch that evolution thread through the entire story.
Yeah, I think there had to be an epiphany moment, because it's also interesting how when they were in a they had a band with a different singer, Zeno, for like a year and a half, and they only had two or three original songs that whole time. And then all of a sudden, after Robin joins the band, Rick writes like 40 songs in a year or two.
Right.
So obviously something was going on there, and I think it was Rick finally had a singer who could sing anything. When he realized Robin could sing anything from the softest melody to the most insane screaming maniac, then Rick could literally write anything. So, yeah.
But it's also fascinating to hear the way Rick found his, for lack of a better term, onstage character or persona. And the same thing with Bunny, the way they kind of all had to figure out how they could all be this person and who that person was in an interesting way. That, like, the same thing even with the Cheap Trick logo, like, to see a band become what they are and so identifiable and, like, start to build that, here's what the first couple records are going to be like. This guy's on front, this guy's on the back, and all of that. Like, you get such a great insight into it that it's not the manipulation of it, it's not the like, but it's building these characters in a way, almost like Kiss, where you're seeing Rick finding out, here's what I can do, and here's how I can work around this great lead singer, like Heidi was saying, and how that interplay goes. It's so fascinating, just the dynamic of these four guys on stage and how they all complement each other.
Yeah, it's kind of a series of happy accidents in a lot of ways. You know, like Bunny said, he just happened, he was with Zeno when Zeno was getting his hair dyed, and the girl was like, you should cut your hair. And he just on a whim got his hair cut short because he had long hair. You know, there's pictures of Bunny with really long hair, but he was losing his hair. And, you know, Bunny was never really going to look like a rock star. And it was kind of the same with Rick. And, you know, that there's the story that Brad Elvis tells, which I think is believable, especially if you look at the photographic record. There's no picture of Rick with a hat before July 76, and Brad Elvis would go see every show. He's still an obsessed fan, and he said somebody threw a hat on stage and Rick put it on, and then the next show he's wearing it. And that was in July of 76. There's even pictures from that show. And even in August of 76, when they opened for Peter Frampton, Rich Kwasniewski, a photographer, sent me like 200 pictures he took at that show. And there's pictures of Rick with a hat and without a hat. So at that show, he played part of the show with no hat on. That was in August of 76. So, and this is after they already signed their record deal. Like I say in the book, when the record labels came and saw them, when they got signed by their agency and their label, Rick didn't even wear the hat yet. And that became, I mean, what's more important to Rick Nielsen than that ball cap?
Right.
So, I mean, how does he sign his autographs now? It's the whole caricature with the ball cap.
Yeah.
And he had the cardigan and the bow tie and everything before the hat. The hat was like the last thing. Like this idea that Rick Nielsen looked at Hunts Hall and said, I'm going to look like Hunts Hall. And that's not how it happened, because it all came together piece by piece, you know? And the hat, I think, was an epiphany. It served a purpose because Rick was losing his hair. But also, it just added so much to his character. And he was already this wild, wacky character on stage. He was always like that, even before he was wearing the sweaters and the bow ties. If you read reviews of early shows, they always talk about how the guitar player is crazy. That's all. Even with Fuse, they talk about how he's crazy and wacky. So he was already acting crazy on stage, even before he had put the whole like persona together.
Yeah. So it took you 5 years to write the book. Obviously you have the podcast about the band. You've so much of your life has been intertwined with this band. Can you still listen to these records and enjoy them as much? Or is it just feel like I need a break from heaven tonight?
No, I would never be sick of Cheap Trick.
This Band Has No Past by Brian Kemp is available starting next Tuesday, September 6th, wherever you get your books.
You can check us out on all the various socials. Be sure to visit our website at rockandrollgradschool.com. And don't forget to leave us a review.
Today's show is produced by myself and Heidi Hagquist. Our reluctant producers are John Sauvay and Sandy Stone. Our willing producers are Rachel Allen and Randy Jeanette. Our intern is Zach Jackson. This one's for Philippe. Thank you, good night, and may all your favorite bands stay together.